Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderput.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We always hear about visitor numbers, but what if you track where they're going next and when? We sit down and talk research numbers with OmniTrack President Chris Kam and why an upcoming exhibit on the beginning and end of the bomb may be more relevant than ever. We sit down with the show's curator, Michael Jones.
Business coach Cynthia Yamasaki looks at the way the Me Too movement is forcing a reckoning in the workplace. And the stage show Masters of the Currents is both a nod to a heroic past in Micronesia and a hard look at a community's life in Hawaii.
It's Friday, March 7th, March 2nd, and the conversation starts right after the news. Most of us are familiar with the survey forms that travelers are asked to fill out on the plane that track how long visitors stay and how much they spend. It's that kind of data research that is helpful to the tourist industry. OmniTrack Group, a local research company, is taking that a step further by teaming up with one of the largest agencies in the world. Travel America is being rebranded as TravelTrack America. We sat down with OmniTrack President Chris Kam to talk about this latest venture.
Out here in Hawaii, we're a little bit spoiled as far as travel and tourism research is concerned. We have the Hawaii Tourism Authority, which calculates visitor arrivals, visitor spending, looks at visitor characteristics. Other states across the mainland, not quite as so lucky because they have this thing called interstates. Interstates which actually go between states, unlike what we have out here. So they have a hard time calculating into how many visitors arrive in their state each year, how much they spend each year, and so forth. So they rely on nationally syndicated research programs, and one of these was Travels America. And late last year, we heard that Kantar TNS, the company that used to run Travels America, was very interested in getting out of the business. And at the same time, we know our expertise in travel and tourism. OmniTrack has been doing travel and tourism research since probably dinosaurs roamed the land. And we'd been doing the departure surveys at the airport. We do work for duty-free shoppers. We do work for the Tourism Authority and Hawaiian Host. We said, no, this is a great area for us to get into. And I was actually a Travels America subscriber because it's a subscriber service back when in my days at the Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau. And as soon as we heard that this may be up for play, we contacted the people at Kantar TNS and said, you know, can we make a deal? And we were eventually able to make a deal. And so now we are the licensee of formerly Travels America. Now we call it TravelTrack America. And basically it tracks travel volumes, visitor traveler spending, and characteristics nationwide.
So what does this mean for Hawaii?
What does it mean for Hawaii? Well, It puts Hawaii on a national stage. I mean, it shows that Hawaii has the expertise. Then we've demonstrated that with our capabilities at crunching the Hawaii visitor volumes. But now let's do the same thing for the nation as a whole. Let's export this expertise. And we're not only becoming the licensee of taking over TravelTrack America, but we're going to plan on continuing it, but also evolving it based on what we've learned through all our many years of crunching Hawaii visitor data. How can we take this to the national stage now? In the past, you know, a lot of the data out in the market has always been backwards looking. How many Japanese visitors came? How many Korean visitors went somewhere? We're taking the model now and reversing it. We wanted to conduct some more forward-looking data, and so we came up with a program called Travel Era Asia. TEA is the acronym. T, if you don't like the title, that's my fault. I came up with it. But what it does is it tracks outbound travelers from the three largest Asia markets, China, Korea, and Japan, sorry. Basically, we on a quarterly basis, we do 900 interviews. We have 400 from the China market, 250 each from South Korea and Japan. And we ask them things about travel intentions. Where are you planning to go in the next 2 years? Where are you actively planning to travel in the next 12 months? And not only your travel intentions, but how do you feel about travel? Are you at this time compared to the same time last year? Were you more interested in? Are you more interested in travel? Less interested in travel? The same? Do you think travel is safer now than it was before? How are your personal finances more conducive to traveling now than they were a year ago, and so forth? And do you think exchange rates are getting more conducive to travel as well?
So how are you getting those interviews with the 900 people? These are folks that have participated in previous surveys?
I personally go door to door. No, just kidding. No, what we do is we do it online, basically. It gives us the a look at how people feel about travel, and how are these confidence in travel confidence is what we're calling it. How does this travel confidence actually convert into actual travel intentions?
And then could that be used then to market specifically to them?
Yes, because we're not only tracking it just on total outbound, and we're not tracking it specifically for Hawaii, but we measure total outbound and by destination where they are interested in going and what kind of activities they're interested in doing. Boeing is expected to deliver more planes to the Asia-Pacific region than any region in the world over the next 20 years.
Why is that?
Because that's where it's coming online as a new market, basically. That's where the travel demand is picking up, and that's where they see the greatest need for new aircraft.
So then the lift capacity will just...
Increase, yes.
Increase.
As demand grows, so does lift. We benchmarked our Travel Air Asia research program in the first quarter of 2017, and we're coming up on having our first year-over-year data to look at, and that's where it starts getting interesting. But the Travel Track America data is we're just launching right now as we speak, and we're taking learnings from the U.S. Travel side, and we're implementing some of those learnings, like we have questions on insights into people's digital habits and how they use travel, digital channels to research and navigate their way as they go to destinations. So we're taking those kind of insights, putting into the Asia market, and then we're taking some insights from the Asia market that we glean and putting those questions and integrating them into our U.S. travel efforts as well.
What about travel from places like Canada?
Canada, it's on our radar. We'll probably be entering the Canada market in the future. I don't have a solid time frame on that, but for many destinations, it is their largest international travel market. The people we work with in the U.S. travel product have expressed great interest in us taking a look and entering that market.
Anything else you can share with us just about the outlook for Asia, for Korea and Japan?
Well, so far what we've seen is, as we started surveying people in the first quarter of 2017, and travel demand has been very strong out of the Asia region, despite all the changes in global events. We've seen some ebb and flow in terms of the concerns over safety of travel, especially the Japan market is very concerned over safety. I think we saw a little weakness in the second and third quarters of last year, but then it came back it strengthened again in the fourth quarter of last year.
Was that due to the missile threats?
No, we were in the market before the missile threats, but I think what's going to happen, we are actually fielding research right now in Asia for the first quarter of 2018, and that's one of the things we're going to be looking at. Is there any impact from the missile threats?
And those results should be out later this month. We were talking with OmniTrack Group President Chris Kam about the latest expansion with TravelTrack America.
This is a conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, developing a set of standards for workplace behavior. But first, your quiz. Today happens to be National Read Across America Day.
otherwise known as Dr. Seuss Day. We wanted to test your knowledge on Hawaii's children book authors. Many of Hawaii's keiki grew up reading the classics like Goodnight Hawaiian Moon, Too Many Mangoes, and Honohina. Today we wanted to focus on the book known as How the B-52 Cockroach Learned to Fly, written by Lisa Matsumoto and illustrated by Michael Furuya. This beloved story tells the tale of Kimo, a young cockroach who's tired of living in the garbage and is determined to prove that roaches deserve a respected place in the insect kingdom. His adventures include visiting his local library to research flying techniques and avoid getting squashed by a rubber slipper. The author, Matsumoto, won the 1996 Pu'ukela Award for Excellence in Children's Book Awards for her writing. She went on to write many other children's books, but what you may not know is that Matsumoto is also a playwright. We wanted to know today, what is the name of her first play? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right will get our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative, Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working, and Eye Doctors Hawaii.
It's striking how many of the sexual harassment scandals that have surfaced through the Me Too movement have occurred in the workplace. It's a reminder that harassment is as much about power as it is about sex. The movement shows no signs of going away, and that means workers of both genders need to refine a kind of workplace etiquette that can't be misunderstood. Cynthia Yamasaki is a business coach who conducts seminars in workplace behavior through her EE Path consulting firm.
Harassment can come in all forms, not just sexual innuendos, but also just bullying, just not treating each other with respect and professionalism, where the other person feels threatened or uncomfortable. And it's to the point where it's not only their perception, but if any other reasonable person, male or female, and it's all under that Title VII, you know, laws for discrimination, they can feel offended. And so there's definitions and different laws, and as well as a workplace values and their employee handbook that everyone should be aware of and always practice it.
Well, the idea of being witnessed by another person, is that a standard to apply if a third party might judge a word or deed to have been an act of harassment? That's a pretty good indicator that it is.
It could, and you know, it's a little bit of common sense. So a person should be observant and what I would call look for the signs, you know, if it's inappropriate behavior. But it can be such a gray area, right? Sometimes it could be just that borderline of not sure, because it could be a cultural thing, like in Hawaii where we might greet each other with a kiss on the cheek.
An embrace.
Mm-hmm. But to get to your question about if someone else observes, I think they should be aware. And if they notice, and it depends on the situation, they really feel like there was an obvious breach, to report it or to find out, you know, the information. But there's some subtleties that you need to really check with the other person.
That's where the confusion comes
that
in,
can
in
be.
The area of those subtleties,
yes,
right?
Yes, the subtleties.
I'm wondering how much of this is generational, and I'm thinking of I'm a baby boomer, right? So I grew up perhaps in an environment where I was led to believe that saying, isn't that a pretty, don't you look nice today, that's a pretty dress, that's very flattering to you. At what point does that cross a line?
You know, it could be taken the wrong way by the person, that the tone of voice, the proximity that you're standing to the person.
That's where the subtleties come in.
That's the subtleties come in, and you just have to be careful. I think when it's someone brand new that you're meeting, you might want to keep away from those personal observations and comments because you don't know how they're going to interpret it to be. You know, it just depends, right, on your values, your, like you said, generation, the etiquette that we were raised with or know, and some other people might take it the wrong way. Like, well, what do you mean? Does it mean, you know, what do you mean by that? And they look into it. So,
Because there are incidents where the perceived aggressor might think his or herself to have been perfectly innocent. I was just trying to be friendly.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure you hear that,
yes.
Right?
Yes. And so many times they say, well, that wasn't my intent.
Yeah.
But that's not the test. The test is really was it perceived by a reasonable person and the frequency of it and the pervasiveness.
The fact that so many of the harassment accounts have come from the workplace, what's the significance of that?
I think it's because we're working with people, and it's not only within the workplace with each other as employees. It's by where you are, whether it's supervisor to subordinate, mm-hmm. or manager to subordinate, or even with customers sometimes, with clients. And in those gray areas that, you know, I like to share with people and I see how they can practice and be aware of it, just mm-hmm. be aware, is how do you handle it diplomatically? Don't have to feel uncomfortable walking on eggshells,
yeah.
but without saying the right message, but in a very diplomatic, tactful way. So within the workplace, I think harassment has occurred for many years.
Sure. You know,
in my experience over three decades with HR background, as well in corporations, major global corporations, as well as local companies and small nonprofits, it's because it always involves people. And we come from diverse backgrounds, experiences, and values. So
has it gotten better over those three decades?
Well, you know, I think that's interesting. And the reason why that I have this new workshop that I call Respect at Work mm-hmm. is with the Me Too, you know, it really started back in 2006, the Me Too concept of making sure that there were more from the sexual harassment and more rights, mm-hmm. you know, for women. But and then it really, with the internet and Twitter, it just exploded back in October 2017.
Yeah.
So there's more awareness, which I think is a good thing. Because in my experience in HR, when we provide that training, it's constant compliance training is very important. It always has been, well, what is it? What is harassment? What are the laws? And very factual.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's important is for people to know, well, what is it, but how do I handle it? And how do we do it with respect and for what purpose? Not to make people feel uncomfortable on how do I approach you, but just use some common sense.
We've seen a great many men, and I'll talk specifically about men for a moment, fall from grace.
Yes.
Since October in particular, when this groundswell began, many of them fell from grace on no more than an accusation. And I'm not deciding whether those accusations were fair or not, but there is that thing of an accusation is one thing, proof is another. Has the pendulum swung too far the other way to where an accusation is all you need to bring down an authority figure at work? And that could be male or female.
Well, I believe that it's a very sensitive thing. And what we're seeing in the media may be just one perspective. But in the true practice of investigations, it's something that's very confidential, and many people women don't feel comfortable bringing it up
mm-hmm.
for various reasons. You know, things like they feel afraid that there's going to be retaliation, or in larger companies when you have human resources, or smaller companies where the owners are the, you know,
sure.
they will feel uncomfortable because of the relationship that HR has with the top decision makers. They don't feel like there is a neutral zone, that would be really fair. So I think that it's always been prevalent, but it's not only now people are becoming more comfortable to speak up. But the true cases involves a lot of investigation to make sure that it's factual and not just based on one observation or one
yeah.
opinion.
When you come into a company to consult with them and maybe raise awareness of this, what kind of steps do you take?
So initially it would be just to find out interviews, finding out what's happening, what are the symptoms, and then really try to come down to what is the root cause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, communication, misunderstanding, or maybe just ignorance, unawareness.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be many different reasons, but it would be to make it known. And if there's, it's a process where people understand that it's a breach of your company policies and ethics, that's why it's so important to have like an employee handbook,
mm-hmm.
that it may be directly breach of the laws that are out there. So, you know, it's a step-by-step process and like a CSI investigation.
Sure.
Yes.
When you present those guidelines within an organization, do some people profess surprise at what they are? I didn't know that this was inappropriate. Do you hear that?
Yes. Sometimes, you do hear that.
So there's an educational component.
There's an educational component to that, yes.
Cynthia Yamasaki is the founder of EEPath, which conducts workshops for businesses on etiquette in the workplace. If you can learn more about her and her work on the Conversation Facebook page. From the start of the tech revolution, the state of Hawaii has boasted of its potential as a center of innovation and has supported its claim through its support of efforts like the Manoa Innovation Center, which for 25 years has been supported by the Hawaii Technology Development Corporation. Now the center is about to get a new landlord, raising concerns about its future. Stuart Yurton has the story in today's Reality Check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris.
Is this as I said, the state has long been, touted its support of the tech industry. Is this any kind of a moving away, do you think?
No, not really, Chris. This is essentially what's happened is the UH has owned the land and has given a lease to a sort of master lease to the Hawaii Technology Development Corporation, which has then sort of sublet the offices there to startup companies to help mm-hmm. them. Help them get a leg up as sort of a business incubator. That lease is over, and UH says we want to take over the center now.
But it's raising concern among startup companies, yeah?
Sure. Well, they're wondering, what's going to happen? And I think for them the real question is HTDC has really been sort of like a booster, almost like a mini chamber of commerce for tech companies, helping these companies connect with people, helping them connect with investors, venture and angel investors, things like that. So the question is UH going to do the same thing? Are they going to be more like just simply a landlord? How's that going to work? Plus, it seems like UH probably in the long term is going to really focus on commercializing technology that's coming out of UH and not necessarily being something for everyone. That remains to be seen. The university says we're not going to kick anybody out. So as of now, it really could be any tech company could go in there.
Does becoming the landlord place a kind of budgetary pressure on the university?
Well, it lets them make more money. So that's a good thing. It's more like revenue, and that could be part of their motivation. They can get more revenue than they did before because they pretty much gave just let the Technology Development Corporation use the property.
Well, who does it put pressure on? The startup companies?
No, it puts pressure on the Technology Development Corporation. So it generated its operating money by leasing the office space to these companies. So that's how it paid its bills.
Mm-hmm.
It now won't have any money to pay its bills until unless the legislature steps in and gives them money. And that's where we are now. They're trying to get money from the legislature, and there are a couple of bills that would give them money.
What kind of money would they need?
They're looking at right now what's on the table seems to be just under $1 million. I believe the last operating budget for the corporation was about $1.4 million previously. So we're looking at about $1 million now. I don't know where the rest of the money could come from, but that's what we're looking at, is about $1 million. And it seems like that's what the legislature is considering.
Pretty hard to predict at this point, isn't it, Stuart?
It is, but it does look like the legislature and the governor's office, from what I understand, are interested in helping out this Hawaii Technology Development Corporation.
Well, thanks, Stuart. That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check from Civil Beat.
Hi, I'm Ken Cribbs from the Pacific Pet Alliance. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Earlier this week, we talked about the increasing density of neighborhoods with apartments masquerading as a single-family or two-family homes. Mayor Kirk Caldwell told HPR he intends to sign the monster home moratorium bill into law, provided it passes final legal muster with city attorneys. The mayor realizes the large structures help meet a housing need, but he agrees that the city needs a timeout to rework the city's land use ordinance.
We want them to build in the proper place. It's not trying to say we don't want you to build at all, but it's where you build. So it doesn't have that impact that you're hearing from communities around this island, where they're saying, really, this is not a single-family home. This is an apartment that affects dramatically the lifestyle and nature of our community where these homes are built.
We also heard from our listeners about that panel, and here's what one Oahu caller had to say.
Hello, my name is Tracy. I'm calling from Kaimuki. My big concern with these homes is they just reek of human trafficking. That's my concern, what kind of activities are going on in this home, because I don't see it as a home filled with multi-level families. I'm worried about human trafficking. So maybe if you could just mention something about that. Thank you.
Following our discussion of gun violence in the wake of February 14th mass shooting at a Florida high school, we got this.
Hi, this is Lori Atwood. I live in Waipahu. The CDC has been precluded from studying in any way ownership or use or effects of use of guns in this country. And that's been for some time. And also, any doctors that take federal monies, Medicaid, Medicare, any of that, cannot discuss gun use with their patients. Because I know a lot of pediatricians really wanted to ask parents when they came in that their kids, is there a gun in the home? Is it safe and secure? Blah, blah, blah. And they cannot do that legally.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I'm calling from Haiku, Maui. My husband is a combat veteran, and we both firmly believe strongly that the shooter needs to have the death penalty immediately, and they need to broadcast it on TV or whatever. They need to shock the kids out of it. I think that in the end that it would really show kids, if you do this, we're going to get it. Very strong statement, but I think it's true.
Dylan Jones wrote to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org and said, I'm concerned about the slippery slope of age limits to a constitutional right. If we arbitrarily set 21 as a limit for guns, will we do the same with speech to prevent bullying? Will we do the same with Fourth and Fifth Amendments just because they can't vote?
We thank you for your thoughts. If you ever want to comment on something you heard on this program, you can call our TalkBack line at 808-792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from iDoctors Hawaii, now open in the Hawaii Kai Town Center, dedicated to the patient-doctor relationship and making therapeutic decisions together. iDoctorsHawaii.com.
This is Ray Cruz, host of Latin Beat. We're thrilled to announce that American Roots will be returning to our air tomorrow. This two-hour celebration of American music, blues and jazz, gospel and soul, old-time country and rockabilly, Cajun and Zydeco, Tejano and Latin, roots rock and pop, avant-garde and classical, has always delighted our listeners. Tune in Saturday nights at 6 starting tomorrow and become a fan of American Roots.
The beginning and end of the bomb. It's a thought-provoking exhibit that opens at Kapi'olani Community College Library next Monday. Show curator Michael Jones sat down with us to give us a preview. The show grew out of the 50th anniversary of World War II and included the years of nuclear testing in the Pacific. The exhibit has traveled across the state, but it now includes a section looking toward the future. Given last month's missile scare, the timing of the show is probably more relevant than ever.
Well, given the false alert last month, I think there will be more interest in it. And I think it's definitely needed because people need to confront the issue of what we're going to do about the threat from nuclear weapons. Either we're going to get rid of them entirely, which a lot of people advocate, or if we're going to keep them indefinitely, how do we prevent them from being used or from terrorists getting their hands on them?
Right. And the Matsunaga Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution is helping to put this exhibit on.
The main sponsor of the exhibit, yes.
And so who do you hope to reach with this? Maybe folks who didn't see the previous exhibits?
Well, I'm hoping people will come back, even if they saw the one in 1995. But I think the main focus is students at KCC, first of all, and then the general public as well. So it's intended to have a broad appeal, certainly.
Right, and many of the KCC students may not know a lot about the history of the bombing that went on in the Pacific in the 1940s.
Yeah, well, a lot of them were probably born after 1995 as well. So.
Right, and we had the bikini tests. There were Johnson Island.
Yeah, we have some photographs that were taken from Hawaii of Johnston Island, including some Life magazine photographs of people on the beach watching the high-altitude nuclear test. And we have some photographs from Bikini as well.
And I know there's a concern about the electromagnetic pulse effect and what that might do to our electronics, and seeing how young kids these days are so reliant on their electronics, it's a scary thought.
That's a very difficult issue. I mean, there haven't been a lot of tests done on that. Sometimes people cite the test above Johnston Island as causing major havoc with electronics on Oahu. But in fact, only a few streetlights burned out. It was a very, very minor incident. The other difference now is a lot of the communications is by fiber optics, and they're not susceptible to electromagnetic pulse effects.
Right, but a lot of...
Certainly copper wire systems are susceptible.
And so how did this exhibit come about? Where did you have to curate your items?
Well, I did a lot of that myself for the 1995 opening. And we got some things from Los Alamos. Other things were donated to the Peace Institute. There are some photographs of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki peace bells in Honolulu that not many people are aware of that I took myself. And we tried to have a variety of things that would give people a flavor of what was going on in 1945 and as well how subsequent effects impacted Hawaii.
And will there be any, I don't know, talks or any curriculum tied to this exhibit that you know of?
Well, I'm hoping some KCC faculty will bring their classes or encourage their students to come. We may be able to arrange a panel discussion about civil defense measures for Hawaii. I'm still working on that, and that hasn't been finalized yet. But because of the false alarm last month, I think there would be a lot of interest in that. And that's connected with the exhibit as well.
Right, because the video that we saw was of university students running when people first got that alert on their cell phones, and they were alarmed and were running to their dorms, I think, or trying to get away or to find shelter.
Yeah, well, in the 1980s, there actually was an emergency plan for the Manila campus that identified space for 31,000 people in buildings on campus. That's subsequently been disbanded, and President Lasser sent out a message saying that there will be a new plan developed that will have crystal clear instructions. Those are his words, not mine. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen. There are lots of issues associated with having shelters, fallout shelters. You're trying to keep radiation out, so what do you do if people come late and they've already been exposed? Do you make them take off all their clothes before they come into the shelter? Do you make them stay outside and not let them in at all? There are just any number of issues that I think people haven't thought through.
Right, and I know at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, they had those areas that were marked as fallout shelters. The signs were still there, but obviously they were not in use. But still, the students ran there because they probably saw those signs, you know, going to class.
Yeah, and even in the 1980s plan, it was made clear that these fallout shelters weren't stocked with supplies, so people would have to bring their own food and water if they were going to imagine staying there more than a few hours.
But certainly this exhibit will kind of put things into focus. A lot of these things have been discussed in different forums since that missile mistake alert went out, and it should be top of mind for everybody. What do you do, and you know, what's the likelihood that you know, you could get to shelter? I know they were talking about, you know, you shelter in place, stay indoors, get indoors, stay indoors, and stay tuned.
Yeah, that's certainly good advice in the very short term, but in the long term, I think it's really problematic how people are going to be able to cope. Even if they've survived and they have enough food and water to stay inside for a week or two, they may face really daunting prospects once they come out.
Anything you hope, anything else that you hope will be spurred by this exhibit and this collection, given that it's, you know, so timely?
Well, I think people need to understand, and I hope this exhibit helps with that, how destructive nuclear weapons actually are, and the urgent need to do something to reduce the threat. As I say, there are two broad approaches that people have followed. The UN has recently been voted on a draft treaty that would prohibit nuclear weapons. The nuclear powers basically ignored that. The U.S. has recently done a nuclear posture review, which argues for replacements for the missiles and bombers that we now have in the Triad. And so that looks like nuclear weapons indefinitely. And if we're going to pursue that, other countries are likely to do as well. And we run the risk of nuclear war between India and Pakistan, or between North Korea and the U.S., or by accident or by terrorism. So it's a really daunting problem, and I think the broader participation in the dialogue about it, the better.
And because you helped to put this exhibit together, is there anything in particular that moves you?
Well, the photographs from Hiroshima and Nagasaki are very moving. I mean, they're very graphic, and we have a warning on that section of the exhibit that the photographs are very disturbing. And I don't do that to try to traumatize people, because we don't want to traumatize people, and particularly we don't want to traumatize children. But on the other hand, I think we have to be honest about what the effects of these weapons used on cities are. And we just have to deal with the consequences of that. And I think the more people know about that and know how destructive they are, I think the better prepared they are to take a risk, for example, for getting rid of nuclear weapons, for nuclear disarmament. That there's a risk involved in that, as well as a risk of keeping them, and people have to decide.
And again, that exhibit opens at Kapi'olani Community College on Monday and runs through May 11th. Visit our Facebook page to see images. I'm Catherine Cruz. This is The Conversation. Thank you.
As we celebrate the joy of reading today, we're testing your knowledge of one of Hawaii's children's book authors. Lisa Matsumoto wrote The B-52 Cockroach That Learned to Fly, the tale that brings to life a funny story about the unusual habits of Hawaii's most feared household pest, the giant B-52 cockroach, known in the book as Kimo. The book was published in 1995, and Matsumoto went on to write several other children's titles. But many don't know that Matsumoto actually went to school for playwriting. She went to UH Manoa for her bachelor's in drama and theater and earned a master's in youth theater. Her style of writing focused on taking Western fairy tales and rewriting them in pidgin while changing their plots in unexpected ways. While she was still in school in the late 80s, Matsumoto wrote her first play, Bye Bye Hanabata Days, for a class assignment. It later went on to become a full theater production.
Congratulations to our winner, Angela Thompson of Honolulu, got it right. That is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, offering flexibility for on-the-go students and families with 24/7 access to Achieve 3000 Hawaii Edition, online or offline. Achieve3000.com.
You could say that the stage play Masters of the Currents writes itself. Each performance is different, and the performers are some of the authors. It's a collaborative theater production led by Los Angeles-based Teata Productions with the participation of the local Micronesian community. It's a show that's been growing and changing with each performance for the last 3 years. It's about the community's struggles in today's Hawaii and its heroic past as master navigators. We spoke with Masters of the Currents co-creator Ova Saupeng as he prepares the inter-island tour that begins this weekend.
The word navigation is really a great way to look at the way that Masters of the Currents has, in stages, been navigating different waters.
Mm-hmm.
And as we create and sculpt and shape it, it's almost like a journey in which we travel with a group of people, and then sometimes we, some people get off on it on land, and then we add more people, and then we supply up with more things, and we journey on again. So this journey has been continually evolving. The current version that we are doing right now was based from our October presentation at Honolulu Theater for Youth.
Mm-hmm.
And within that, we are adding, I think, about another 10 to 15 minutes of more scene and more work that we had developed even from previous sharings. So because there's such a width of stories just that we have worked with, and because we have been developing this piece for close to 3 years now, there has been so many stories and fragments that we would hope to find a way to piece in.
By continually consulting with and using, having in the show people from Micronesian communities, it kind of builds in some authenticity to your presentation, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It is very authentic, and also very raw. I mean, there's a raw and richness to it that no one else can kind of speak from that experience. And so this is monumental to be able to have four Micronesian actors, three representing Chuuk and one representing Kosrae. Having these authentic community performers, really, they're from the community, and we are in a sense in their authentic stories and their authentic knowledge. They're teaching us as theater artists, and we are teaching them, the practice of the theater and performance. So this journey and this tour that we are on is something that is new for us as well as for them, and it's exciting.
It's also kind of new to theater in a sense, over that. Instead of having the script be that which dictates everything else that happens, you're flexible in that regard.
Yes, very much flexible. And that's what's great about the work that we do, community engagement. And sometimes, you know, within working with new people, the work or the piece leads itself to a new discovery or a new story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's great. So, for example, this past presentation, we were led by very youthful stories because it became more focused on three primary characters who basically were experiencing Hawaii as a young person from Micronesia, one from Marshall Islands, one from Chuuk, and one from Kosrae. So it is their stories and their journey facing discrimination at the same time figuring out how do they connect with their ancestry, their tradition, and navigate this new world, this in a sense new system.
And yet the story behind, you know, the premise of Masters of the Currents, using navigation as the metaphor, is a restoration of cultural pride. Yeah.
Very much so. Very much so. Finding a way to have audiences understand the connection of the traditions and how does one take one's tradition and either amend it or adjust it to a different tradition, you know. So that is something that has been a journey for definitely Masters of the Currents. And yes, it is a great metaphor in life to see as we journey and navigate through this thing we call life.
Well, you know, and there's a little bit of a sad undercurrent in the way, in the process by which that very cultural pride can be taken away in a new environment, how it can be sort of left behind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And sadly, I mean, to add to that, it just reflects, I mean, it is a specific community here, but I see it, the ripple effects of that nationally. I see the ripple effects of that globally.
Sure.
In terms of what is going on at our current times right now, in terms of just, you know, the vitriolic tones about immigration and refugees, and we're losing touch with the aloha spirit. We are losing touch with the sense of America being welcoming to everyone, you know, and it's shifting. And this Masters of the Current hopefully will be a reminder for people to find a way to be compassionate and to have understanding that we are all in the same boat. In the piece, there is a refrain that we keep on sharing with the audience about same boat, same boat. We all in the same boat.
Well, you know, you think of so many stories of, I mean, I don't know if anyone has any kind of a figure of how many displaced persons there are in today's world, but that's a pretty universal story, isn't it?
It is. It's a very universal story, and so it's a human story. It's a story that I have had to go through in terms of personally for myself being a Lao American, and I can see it connect with the communities that's going on right now with the Rohingya and with other communities that are dealing with displacement, forced displacement, you know, I mean. So the Micronesian story in Hawaii and Guam has a lot for us to learn from. It is something that is very, very universal.
Your task you're taking the show to Minnesota, and you're not going to find many people there who are at all familiar with Micronesians and, you know, that culture and even where it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is a task that when we leap over to the continent, as far as our job in terms of performing artists, how do we then connect them and teach them as much as we can about the Micronesian community? And you're right, not many people will know about Micronesia, but when we get there, they're going to know about Micronesia, but they're also going to know how important that story can relate to them in terms of the universal and the global impact. Our first mainland presentation will be in San Francisco at Brava Center for the Arts, mm-hmm. and then in California, and then we go to Minnesota. And I know that there, from so far from our brief research and our presenters, there are some Micronesian communities throughout the West Coast. In Minnesota, surprisingly, there is a Micronesian community, but way in a town called Milan, or Milan, in Minnesota, which is very far from the city of Minneapolis. We're going to be presenting it in Minneapolis, but it's definitely going to be interesting to bring it there. But I feel that there is going to be a lot of connection in terms of indigenous stories, in terms of Native American stories, in terms of American imperialism and colonialism and the impact of the way that our governments and these national nations have worked together to have this impact on this community.
Cast member Ova Saopeng is also one of the lead artists of Teyata Productions that developed the play Masters of the Currents. The Inter-Island Tour kicks off tomorrow at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's McCoy Studio Theater at 7:30. The company then flies to the Big Island, will be on stage at the UH Hilo Performing Arts Center Thursday, March 8th, also at 7:30 p.m.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, and Hawaii Pacific University.
I'm Ira Flato. On the next Science Friday, a private aerospace company plans to build a new commercial space station. We'll talk about how a private space station melds with Trump's plan to cut off funding for the International Space Station. Plus, the mystery of some neutron stars shining far brighter than they should be. We'll investigate on the next Science Friday from PRI.
This afternoon at 1.
That's it for this week. Coming up next week, we'll talk to storyteller Jeff Geer about his new Arabian Nights evening.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on the Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR.
If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can always find our playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, where you can also listen back to today's show. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finity, and Amber Khan Grusby. Our intern is Emily Cardinale.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.